to ACMN Conversations, a podcast about marketing, media, and entertainment matters in Australia. I'm ACMN's Managing Director, Lyndall Pond, and today we are very excited to have Stuart Buchanan joining us, certainly one of the most knowledgeable digital experts in our industry. Stuart is a man with an extensive career in digital media and the arts. From developing the very first website for the Edinburgh Festival to founding an award-winning digital agency, Stuart's passion lies in what he calls the intersection of art, technology, and media. Stuart is now based at the Sydney Opera House, which I think we can say is recognised as Australia's most iconic performing arts venue. At the House, as it's affectionately known, he curates the digital programming, delivering impactful and online events to audiences near and far. As the rest of the world embraced digital programming and live streaming through a challenging year for the arts and entertainment industry, Stuart and his team were already owning this space. The man responsible for bringing the Opera House stages to your sofa, we are so thrilled to be chatting to Stuart today. So Stuart, welcome.
Hi, Lyndall. So nice to be here.
Thank you so much for your time. You've had such an eclectic and varied career. I want to learn a little bit more about that and share that with our listeners. So you have had that diverse career in the world of digital, maybe even starting in digital before we all really knew what digital was. So do you want to tell us about some of your career highlights?
I mean, that was a lovely pricey at the top. Thank you. And I think a lot of the highlights are probably in there. But, I think starting with that first website for The Fringe back in 1996, I'm going to say, I think. And I remember the Scotsman, which is the national newspaper, you know, for Scotland, you know, had like a top 10 cultural websites. It was like the only 10 cultural websites in Scotland at the time. But, you know, the reason I kind of mentioned that is that I think, you know, most of the things that I've enjoyed from a highlights perspective since then have been very similar insofar as doing something that had either never been done before or seemed impossible or not really having, you know, having the idea about what you wanted to do and how it looked, but not really having an idea of how to do it. That tends to be how I work, it has to be said, you know, that the kind of idea or the creative idea comes first and then we worry about whether or not it can be done. And that often gets you into trouble, of course. Now, at the Opera House, one of the things that when I walk into the Opera House is actually a kind of little manifesto on the wall. And one of the things in that manifesto says, you know, that the Opera House makes the impossible possible. And, you know, because the idea of actually building something like that was impossible. It seemed impossible. And that, you know, I think actually kind of makes me smile because it is exactly what a lot of my career feels like in that sense of, you know, not knowing whether or not something was possible and just trying to make it so, you know, and because that's how you innovate, you know, that's how you move things forward, not by copying or besting necessarily, but by saying, how do we make it different? How do we make it more equitable? You know, how do we make it more accessible? How do we make it more interesting?
I think that's the path of any digital person, isn't it? Like it's that digital discovery, because that world is just evolving before our very eyes. So having that discovery mentality is how the digital world evolves anyway.
That's right. That's right. And I remember talking to someone recently, you know, we're talking about career, you know, and about, you know, what thinking ahead, whether that's 5, 10 years or so on. And they sort of made the observation that, you know, people working in, you know, this industry or this facet of the industry, the jobs haven't been invented yet. You know, you actually, and a lot of the time, if you pick up a job, you're often the first person to do the job, you know, and I hadn't really thought of that before. And then I sort of looked back and reflected on some of the roles that I had, and I went, yeah, I was the first person in that job, in that position, no matter whether it was junior or senior or what have you. And so, yeah, when you kind of say, well, what's next? You're like, I don't know, because maybe the job doesn't exist at the moment.
And that's sort of your role at the Opera House now, isn't it? It's a new role.
That's right.
And so there you go again. I wanted to ask you, and obviously the newness is important, but what was the remit when you started and how has that sort of changed since then?
Well, digital programming had been a facet of work at the house for probably the best part of a decade. And I sort of came on board about 18 months ago. It was kind of spread. There was individuals working on various different facets of digital programming throughout the house in kind of, you know, junior or kind of mid-level roles. And with my role, they decided that, you know, to put a senior leadership position in against digital programming and sort of bring all those roles together under one department to sort of coalesce and essentially wrap a strategy around it and sort of realize that, you know, more and more people were engaging with the Opera House through digital channels. But because it was dispersed, because there wasn't a centralized strategy, there was sort of, it wasn't very efficient, you know, and it wasn't really being driven in a particular way, and it wasn't necessarily aligning, you know, with the it wasn't laddering up, as they say, to the broader Opera House strategies. So the remit was really to kind of bring everybody together under one department and one vision, if you like, and to create a strategy that pulls it together. In the main, digital programming, you know, has focused on event recordings or live streams, not exclusively. There's a lot of original content in there, but that was essentially the remit, you know, to make sense of something that was dispersed, I suppose, and to consider how it might evolve. And so, I sort of spent the first few months sort of putting my hypothesis together and my strategy together, and delivered it to the executive of the Opera House. And I think I delivered it like the first week in March in 2020. And then the third week in March in 2020, of course, we closed for COVID. And somebody, you know, very kindly said, oh, here, I think we've already got a digital strategy because Stuart gave us something a couple of weeks ago. and we were off, you know. And so the role changed considerably because what I'd put in the strategy, I thought at the time was, you know, it was very future-facing. It was something we would do over 2 or 3 years and, you know, we would grow into it and make mistakes and, you know, and it was quite, you know, kind of long-term. There were some short-term things, but it was essentially quite long-term in its outlook. But essentially the executive said, let's just do it all now. You know, this is the time to do it, of course. How much can you do now? How quickly can we bring it forward? So, you know, 3 years became 3 months, basically, which is weird because we're now kind of, you know, a year later or 15 months later, that three-year strategy is done.
That sums up digital, you know, the world of digital, though, doesn't it? Like, obviously things had to accelerate last year, but it just moves so quickly.
That's right.
I'm not surprised that you experienced that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And it's, you know, we kind of joke, but it's true that what we see now might not be true in 3 months' time.
I suppose one of the consistent things, and I wanted to ask you about this, is content. Like at the core of what you're creating, it's content, and that's sort of that buzzword. But for you, it's about taking content and that development and distribution to a whole new level. So can you give us either an example or some insight into what you're doing there in terms of that distribution and true today, I guess, and maybe where it's heading?
Well, look, I mean, everything the Opera House had released up until, you know, even 6 months ago, I think, was all distributed and released for free. You know, so the biggest change, I think, is sort of now learning the lesson of COVID and seeing the opportunity and seeing the way the market has shifted to realize that we have to now value, you know, add more value, you know, allow digital presentations to be seen as something that are worthy of spending money on as a consumer, expecting to be free. Like, we don't expect Netflix or Disney Plus or Apple to be free. You know, why would we tune in to watch a, you know, 60, 120 minute theater piece and expect that to be free online? It has been free online primarily for a very long time. So the main shift out there was to say, you know, that we want to essentially, you know, move into a world in which, rather than we can have a kind of dual proposition for audiences, which is, do you want to buy a ticket to watch in the theater, or do you want to buy a ticket to watch it online? You know, it's a little way off that kind of for every show we do at the Opera House, but we've done it now for some shows. You know, for the first time earlier this year, we launched a talks festival, and I don't mean for the first time we had a talks festival. I mean, for the first time this year, we had digital tickets and physical tickets on sale on the same day. So on the day of release, you could make that decision. And the first question everybody asks about that is, does digital cannibalize the physical audience? And, you know, I think our research, although it's in a little bit of in its infancy, but certainly what our research has told us and what we intuit from the data and from, I guess, you know, some learnings from overseas as well, is that digital audience is in a large part a new audience. And so it becomes somewhat of an audience development exercise, that you're actually creating an extended audience beyond those whose proclivity is to come and sit in the auditorium. So that's really where we're heading, number one. And then number two is, you know, looking at, screen-based performing arts practice. You know, how do we marry digital and live performing arts? What comes out of that marriage? And so we're commissioning quite a lot of work in that space. So those are the kind of two rough strands to what we're doing.
So I understand that you work off three pillars, and I think you've probably talked us through two of those critical ones, the third then being the digital creative learning. Can you tell us a little bit more about that piece?
Yeah, that was probably the first thing that the Opera House did in terms of digital programming back in the, you know, back about, as I say, about 10 years ago. And essentially, you know, that is about taking the Opera House into classrooms outside of Sydney. You know, it's understanding that, not all schools, even within the catchment of the Opera House, that not all schools can afford to travel or logistically can travel. And very quickly, when that program started, they started to develop ways in which that can be interactive and two-way. You know, so it's not just about live streams of a school's matinee or whatever. They were running interactive workshops. And we're talking now 8-10 years ago. And when I see the technology that was underpinning that, it wasn't necessarily advanced, but it was just really clever in the way that it was used. You know, you would actually have the presenter standing in front of a camera live streaming into the school, but would actually have very tiny little screens attached to the top of the camera so they could see the pupils at the other end. And this is pre-Zoom, of course.
Wow, yeah.
And so it's pretty far out, I think, pretty forward thinking in terms of what they were doing. And that continues to this day. So, you know, we're looking at ways in which we can not just take the work of the Opera House out to schools, but to find ways where we can have that interactive learning component. Because, you know, we obviously have the privilege at the house of being able to work with and attract artists and producers and educators of a very high caliber. And so, you know, we really want to make sure that we take advantage of that when we're talking about the education space.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the work you do with schools and making something as unique as the Opera House accessible beyond the physical space. So how does that sort of impact programming choices? Like, what kind of stuff do you actually do for them? And I imagine you get a bit of a buzz out of it too, because marketer wants to do audience development of some description.
Yeah, that's right. Look, with the schools, you know, there's a couple of different things in that. We do select a number of shows throughout the year that have a live stream, which are then followed usually by an interactive Q&A. But then the other strand to that is the interactive workshop component. And of course, you know, when we're sort of curating that or programming that, we have to sort of be cognizant about, you know, what can work in that kind of setup. But also, like, what do schools have access to? You know, like, schools have had access to kits for the last couple of years around sort of, you know, virtual reality, and they have like a green screen kit. It's like four or five kits that the New South Wales schools provides, and these kits travel from school to school to school, and they have access to it for a certain amount of time. So we know, okay, they've got a green screen, so we'll have a workshop that, you know, teaches you how to do kind of theater making or filmmaking with the green screen and so on. So that's we it's all curriculum based, so it's trying to blend the Opera House kind of, let's say, the kind of day-to-day kids program that we have at the Opera House with the curriculum, and sort of finding creative ways to do it, and then engaging artists and workshop designers to work with us on those.
That is really cool, isn't it? I mean, yeah, what the kids do at school these days is incredible, but that's, yeah. I mean, green screen's not even a word that we would have had when we were at school.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing, though, but, you know, like, my reflection on some of that is that, we also have to be mindful that in some cases, the technology the kids have access to at home, so it can be better than the technology they have access to at school. And so, you know, when we're thinking about things like, like green screen and VR, we're sort of conscious that, yeah, we've got to pitch it for the schools, but also we've got to pitch the language, you know, in such a way that we understand that maybe the kids are more advanced or doing things of a more advanced level, you know.
So this was obviously an initiative pre-COVID and in various formats you've been doing it anyway. But tell us, how did it change through that time and how the stuff that you learned over the last 12 months, are you sort of thinking, I'm glad we learned that in the last 12 months, we're going to do more of that or we're going to do that differently? What were some of your lessons that you're taking with you?
Oh, look, it's a pretty wide range of things, I think, you know, like the strategy that we set out had, you know, particular tentpole components to it that we focused on. Legal and licensing, of course, is probably one of the biggest and still remains the most complex of those areas. How something is filmed in terms of the production approach is obviously a huge area. The programming / acquisition / commissioning area is another one. And partnerships, you know, who can we work with both locally, nationally, and internationally. So all of those things were, you know, interrogated in some way during COVID, and we had with massive learnings in all of them. I mean, just sort of going into some of those, but quickly, I think one of the kind of key things we learned was, what is the type of legal agreement that is beneficial to artists and beneficial to producers and beneficial to the house? Like, how can we make that trifecta work for everyone, whilst at the same time knowing that this currently, as of 2021, is not a profit-making exercise? You know, now that's not to say it won't be, and you know, we fully expect that it will be, but today it's not. And so, you know, so for example, you know, when we are looking at contracts now, if we're recording something and making it available as a, you know, to rent online as a pay-per-view, then ideally, you know, the way that we design those contracts is that we give a small fee to the producers to ensure that the artists have some kind of remuneration. And from there up, it's a profit split, because it basically means that, you know, everybody's got a little bit of something, you know, the opera house, the artist, the producers, and then whatever money we make on top of that, we split it. You know, so that is the most kind of equitable solution we've found thus far. And in general, people are happy to proceed on those terms, because if suddenly overnight it was a, you know, massive commercial success, then everybody shares in the spoils of that. You know? So when you speak to, you know, some producers working overseas and in Broadway and the West End, and they're 110% behind recording and streaming. Like they know that it's the future. They know that hybrid model of in venue and online is where the growth is going to come from, and where the audiences are going to come, the growth in audiences are going to come from, and they're 100% behind it. So it just, you know.
And tell us, just before we get off sort of like content and what last year was sort of all about, what has been your favorite sort of piece of content or streaming show that you've worked on so far at the Opera House? What's one that really stands out for you?
Oh, look, I'd have to say probably as a whole, you know, the thing that I'll remember to my dying days is the digital stage that we put into the Joan Sutherland Theatre of the Opera House. You know, just that kind of where we had 50 live streams across 7 months or 6 months, which again seems crazy. It's like two live stream shows every week for 6 months, and how we did that, you know, because we had to, in order to do that at scale and speed, You know, we had to standardize the production approach. You know, we had to actually, artists had to fit inside, as opposed to, you know, what usually happens in the opera house, which is tell us what you want, we'll build it for you. So that was pretty challenging. But just that scale, just of taking such an iconic venue and essentially turning it into a TV studio, no audiences, and getting all these artists to come out and perform to no audiences.
I want to switch a little bit to audiences now, and you've talked about some of that already, and I think you've conducted some research on people intending to continue to engage with content in the streaming way and obviously still come to the actual, you know, venues. But has there been a behavioural change that you're continuing to see? Like, what's some of the research showing you that of what you're observing now?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, one of the key pieces of research showed us that the digital audience is younger than the traditional in-venue opera house audience by about 10 years, roughly. And so therefore that impacts on programming considerably. Audiences are also telling us that they are more inclined to watch things online, even paid online, that they wouldn't necessarily do in the real world, because there's less risk, less financial risk, but also maybe they've seen a teaser or a preview or whatever. So again, that's kind of interesting. But also I think that what we sort of referenced earlier, insofar as we're also seeing that a high percentage and a significant high percentage of people who are engaging with our program or our content have not visited the Opera House, or have certainly not visited the Opera House recently. So, you know, that again, that sort of is shining a light on some, you know, a lot of really interesting opportunities that arise. I mean, the other research tells us that people are now somewhat less inclined, or rather kind of more inclined towards on demand than they are live streams, which kind of makes sense. I don't know that I feel that intuitively coming through at the Opera House, but certainly at a research level, that's what the data is saying. But I think what we're doing and will continue to do is both to live stream a performance and then make it available on demand thereafter for as long as possible. Truth be told, so those are the kind of, you know, those, I guess that's some of the top level. Mm-hmm. The other thing I think that I've seen through some Australia Council research that we're looking at this week is that the people who are spending online, you know, are spending on average like $50 to $100 a month on digital arts content, not their Netflix subscription or the Disney Plus subscription, but on arts content. And now that's
solid.
A lot.
Yeah.
You know, solid. And if it's even like, you know, 10% of the audience that are willing to do that, then that's a strong number. So that gives us great confidence that what COVID has done is it's created not just the appetite, but the habit of saying, oh yeah, I'm not going to necessarily think twice about spending $20-$25 to watch a symphony for 90 minutes, you know. Mm-hmm. That's now somewhat a new normal, as opposed to being weird or special or one-off or just COVID. Like, it's now, it's kind of, yeah, it's the norm.
Do you see this as an audience development initiative? Like, do you think that people who are sitting at home watching are buying into the Opera House brand and will one day become your in-person audience? Or do you feel like they're pretty distinct?
I think the former, and that's definitely where our strategy is leaning. So, you know, I think I probably put audience development as pretty close to the top of our priorities, and then the second one, I guess, is developing, or rather expanding the menu for the existing audience. You know, the Opera House has many, many challenges, like most companies and organizations and touring product. You know, finding new audiences, and particularly finding younger audiences and finding more diverse audiences, those are things that have always challenged us since day one and remain challenging, you know. And I think what we've clearly identified is that digital programming on, you know, streaming and so on, it's not only an audience development exercise, but it also talks neatly to some of those priorities. It talks to a younger audience. It can talk to a more diverse audience, because the nature of the product that we can put on a streaming platform is broader than the nature than the product we can put on stage, right? Mm-hmm. Simply just purely from a practicality of the number of days that are available across a calendar year, you know, like, you know, the resident companies of the Opera House and the sort of commercial hire of the Opera House accounts for about 60%. And so therefore, you know, I work in the other 40%. We work in the programming team that covers off the other 40% of the Opera House, you know, like, yes. So therefore our time is limited in terms of what we can actually put on stage, but we're not limited in terms of what we can put online. And that's not just making content, that's also acquisitions. So one of the things we've learned and we're now working on and we'll be developing very strongly, I think, in the next financial year, is acquiring pre-existing digital programs from around the world. And I mean, you know, I'd love to have a very strong representation of local content. But for example, we're working at the moment to showcase a sort of very high caliber UK theatre season towards the end of this calendar year, which hasn't been seen in Australia. It's been seen online in Britain, but hasn't been seen in Australia. So that kind of thing, you think, well, it's not just all about what we're doing. You know, the Opera House brings in touring products all year round. So acquiring something and putting on our streaming platform is exactly the same as just acquiring a touring product, right? It's the same mentality. This is the same programming mentality. You're buying something essentially off the shelf and putting it on your stage. That is acquiring a recording for digital. So all of that together basically says we can curate a program online that can act as a very compelling audience development exercise. But we can also take more risks. There's less financial risk in terms of, you know, investing in a short recording that talks very specifically to an audience that might cost, you know, in the small thousands as opposed to the tens of thousands that it would to do the same thing on stage. So I think all of those things together just make a really interesting and exciting way to onboard future audiences.
And you touched on the international then, and I always think of the Sydney Opera House as a global brand and incredible tourism visitation stats, which obviously are down right now. But, you know, I imagine that perhaps that international programming is going to help with that. But I was also interested in what sort of international results you're seeing from the streaming, because you are such a global brand and people are, you know, in their homes everywhere around the world accessible to it. Have you seen strong uplift in that space as well?
We did during COVID when we had the digital season running. It was a very strong international representation. I'd love to see that reflected in the sales, the digital sales. It's not quite there yet, but I think that's definitely, it's obvious, right? It's an obvious opportunity. When you look at something like, you know, 3/4 of the people that follow us on Facebook don't live in Australia, you know, number one. And, you know, there are 2 million people that follow us on Facebook. So, and they follow us because, as you say, it's iconic. It's the Sydney Opera House. It's like, you know, we're like the Eiffel Tower to some people in that way. And so, you know, I mean, just by the sheer number, you would think, well, there's got to be a latent audience there. Even if it's like 0.1% of that number, it's still a good number. So I think, you know, we've done so much work over the years to cultivate an international audience on social that, you know, I think we all hope that what we now see is an opportunity to activate that audience in a way we've never been able to. You know, we can now say to those audiences, you can now watch something at the Sydney Opera House. You don't have to come, you don't have to get on a plane. You can watch it on the streaming platform and it's $20. And so, yeah, look, that is definitely up there as something that we want to achieve in the longer term.
You and I have spoken about how what you do is running in parallel with the marketing content and the marketing, I guess, of the Opera House. So, you know, I assume you see it as a tool to further enhance that Sydney Opera House brand and hit those KPIs. So it sounds like it's sort of all wrapped up in the same package.
It is, you know. But I think what we've traditionally done, not just the Opera House, but I think as an industry, you know, is that we've gone out to create all this wonderful creative marketing content and then just pause to think, if you turn the camera the other way and point it at the stage, you've already got incredible content there. Mm-hmm. And it feels really almost naive to say that, but it's true to be able to say, how do you actually better leverage the content that is the show as opposed to creating content around the show? Now, creating content around the show is important for context and for engagement and so on. But I think in my experience, I've sort of seen that kind of hesitation, and perhaps it's due to what we're talking about before around rights and actors' agreements and so on and so forth, that it's been hard to do that. But as those things start to change and soften, then the nature of marketing content changes somewhat, because we're able then to leverage more from the show itself and be able to give people tasters and teasers in ways that we've sort of done through EPKs and so on before, but now in a slightly more nuanced way and a slightly more trackable way that we're able to expose people to the actual show itself and, you know, potentially commercialize that. I guess the interesting thing that we're talking, you know, within marketing meetings now about is less about or as much to do with what marketing content do we make versus how do we leverage what we've already got in the can? We've already filmed the show. How do we run that through our channels?
I think traditionally we've avoided showing too much of the show because of the mentality, well, don't show them too much of the show. You want them to buy a ticket and come to the show. But this world of streaming and these shows that are being streamed from Broadway stages and West End stages is proving to enhance the brand, not, you know, diversify that audience or split it down the middle. So it's a real shift of how we've marketed before, you know, show them a bit of the show, but don't show them all of the show.
That's right. And look, the great example is pre-COVID, right? The show, Louise Withers' show, Six. So we co-produced the Sydney run of Six with Louise and had it in the studio at the house. And I was there, you know, on one of the first previews, and sat down in the crowd, and the show starts, and I look around, and half the bloody audience is singing along, like it's never played in Australia before. Yeah. And half the audience is singing along. And why is that? Because the videos have been online, because the soundtrack's on Spotify, you know, like it's there, it's been digitally exploited, if you like, through his runs in the UK and on Broadway. So when it lands here, the audience is ready, it's inbuilt. And the same is true, you know, of other shows. Like my daughter's, you know, is into musical theater, and you know, she knows Dear Evan Hansen back to front, and you know, has never seen it in a theater, you know.
Yeah. So when it does come here, she'll
first
be
in line for a ticket. First in line. Hamilton, like when we watched, like we turned on Disney Plus and watched Hamilton for the first time. And she was sitting there on the sofa with her friend, and they just sang every single word. I didn't hear Lin-Manuel Miranda. I didn't hear them. It was just heard them. And now they're like, you know, we've been desperate to get into Sydney to see it. So, it's
totally shifted.
Fundamentally changed.
It's really quite fascinating.
Yeah.
Now, one last question, which I think, you know, everybody wants to know, what is it like working at the most famous opera house in the world?
Well, it's kind of like it's like a small town. I think it's probably one of the greatest things, because like there's like 1,000 staff plus contractors. So that's not even catering, you know, cleaning, whatever. That's 1,000 staff and contractors, and you know, with shows bumping in and bumping out every day, 7 stages. You know, so just the scale is phenomenal. So you need all that staff to make that happen. So it's, you know, so it is huge. It's wild, you know, because of that, because no two days are the same, and you're constantly being surprised, and you're constantly having to rethink your suppositions about, you know, how things work and how things should be done. But here's the other side of the coin. It's a government entity. It's a public service entity owned and run by the New South Wales government. So you have all of what I've just described, and then all that layer on top of it as well. It's a public sector place. Mm-hmm. So you do have all the very tight rules and regulations and expectations, you know, that are right and proper for a government institution. So and those two things have to somehow coexist, even though they might actually seem at odds with one another, you know, that kind of fluidity and agility and turnover and creative nuance versus the kind of public sector framework. So, you know, it's never not fascinating.
I was going to say,
Yeah.
And what, just one last one on the Opera House, and this has just been such an insightful chat, so thank you for sharing all of that. All the shows that are announced at the moment that are being digitally streamed, what's the highlight in the coming months that we should be telling everyone to tune into?
So we're doing a live motion capture performance with, you know, contemporary dance that's then, the dancers in the room with you, but rendered in live in real time. They're kind of also appearing in some strange fantasy, you know, kind of CGI landscape at the same time. And then another show where we are putting Romeo and Juliet through a what's called a narrative engine. It's basically like artificial intelligence, creative writing software system, and we're seeing what happens when artificial intelligence meets Shakespeare, and getting a bunch of performers to respond to it in real time in front of an audience, which sounds mad. But you know, that's exciting.
Are you in the room when these crazy ideas come up, and you're
Well, unfortunately, fortunately, in both those cases, they were my crazy ideas.
Well, congratulations, they are crazy. You know?
Yeah, and I hope to do many more of those crazy things in the coming years. But I think it's a really fascinating space to bring technology like that into theatre. We're starting to see it more and more, and so what we want to do is kind of play at the fringes and the edges and the experimental kind of innovative end of that, trying to do things that haven't been done before, and they may not work, and they're really risky, we may not pull it off, but we've got to try. It's like what we're saying right at the top of the interview, right? That in fact, these crazy shows that I just talked about, it's like, I've got this great idea, can it be done? Let's see if it can be done. And so there we are.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that. Now, we can't let you leave without a couple of our little key questions that we like to ask at the end. And we'll start with our big philosophical one, but why, in your mind, does arts matter?
Well, you know, I think it matters to me because, you know, it sort of gives me a great deal of joy, you know. It's that moment where you're sort of in awe of something, you know. It sort of goes beyond inspiration and sort of moves into more kind of, you know, wonder, you know, or you kind of like transcend in some way, you know, that something has been presented to you in a kind of creative and artistic way that kind of really kind of transforms you in some way, you know. And that just might mean that you're laughing or you're crying, but great art could do something more powerful than that, and you're a changed person as a result of it.
Yeah, great answer. Thank you. And tell me, where did you discover your love of theatre or entertainment? Have you got a first memory that you can recall?
I think probably at university. I think I wasn't really into theatre or didn't really know much about theatre, but then just started hanging around with people who were happened to be in studying theatre. And so I happened to go and see their work and happened to see a lot of like weird, semi-experimental, often bad, you know, kind of student theater, but at the same time, just loved it, you know, loved what they were trying to do, seeking to do, and the kind of, you know, how they were looking to express themselves and so on. And
well, that theater that you're talking about, that risky stuff, and maybe it works, maybe it doesn't, that's my memory of all of my experiences at the Edinburgh Festival.
Right, exactly.
Great, yeah. Some of it, not so good.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's also part of, you know, part of the joy of what makes theatre great and art great as well. There's the risk, isn't it?
That
you're all in the same room together in that moment. You're like, is this going to work? Is it not going to work? And that's great.
And just one more on your career, because you've just done so many amazing and exciting things. But what is one thing that you'd wish you'd known at the beginning that you could share with our listeners now?
Carve out the requisite time to stop, you know, and think, and, you know, read and watch. And I mean that on a kind of like on a, you know, on your 40-hour work week or however many hours, that it's so easy to just get caught up in the business of work and the busy work that you can forget why you're there in the first place, you know. And some weeks can go by where I realize, oh, I haven't actually been to see something for a while, you know. And so getting so focused on the kind of minutiae in the day to day that you forget why you're there, I guess, you know. So I think I'd sort of, you know, keep telling myself to make sure that I spend the time and have the time to watch the art and see the art and experience it as an audience member as much as anything else.
But you're right. There's nothing better than taking a seat, is there? And breathing out as the curtain goes up and thinking, ah, yes, that's why we do this.
Exactly, exactly. And just making sure that you're in the right headspace, that you give yourself permission to do that as often as you can.
Stuart, thank you so much for all that you've shared and congratulations on all you've achieved. It's one to watch, I think, the work you're doing at the Opera House. And I know I, for one, I'm sure many other audiences look forward to the awe that you will bring to us as you continue just to keep discovering. It's so exciting what you're going to uncover over the next couple of years. So best of luck and thank you.
And thanks, Lyndall. That's very kind. And thanks too for your time.